Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Today's guest is Stephen Josephs. Stephen is a leadership coach and author of Leadership Agility and Dragons at Work. His work helps senior leaders recognize the inner lives and inner patterns that show up under pressure and help them learn how to lead with more awareness, more choices, agility when it actually matters. Very specially, Stephen is also my coach, which makes this conversation very real for me and not at all theoretical. And I'm honored to share this in our podcast. It's called Experience Focused Leaders. And Stephen's work goes straight to the heart of how leadership is experienced from the inside. So Stephen, huge welcome to the pod.
Great to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, I discovered your voice by listening. Somebody recommended Tara Brach at some point, and I was listening. You're one of the first podcast guests that came up there, and I hear your voice, and it turns out you've taught who Tara is well really well known, and you've been her meditation coach and teacher and friend for many years. But I heard your voice and your presence and your humanity, and I had one of these when Harry met Sally moments where you go like, I want to have what he's having type of experience. And you know, I think there was something that just deeply resonated, and I want you to share that experience that I had and bring that to our guests, because I think many people in demanding roles across their professional lives, their family lives, could really benefit from your work. So welcome. And what would you, if we started as a headline for today's conversation, what would be some of the big takeaways that you would want to share with an occasional listener like myself a few months back?
Okay. Well, I think, as I remember, the title of that conversation I had with Tara Brach, she entitled it Getting Over Yourself.
That's right.
And not everyone wants to do that. It's only appealing to some. And the reason is because there are portions of our life or stages of our life where it's really not appropriate to get over ourselves. We're riding with a kind of fuel. And that fuel psychologically is establishing that we are experts, that we are a driving force in achieving our goals. And that is something that keeps us going and makes us want to keep going and to meet all the challenges that come our way, especially if you're an entrepreneur. But it doesn't matter. A lot of my coaching has been done with really established organizations and companies, big high-tech firms. And the place that people get to is that their leadership meets some challenges. And some of the challenges are, if you want to be the smartest person in the room all the time, then you're tough to work for, because your ideas presented to the smartest person in the room are either going to be rejected or even considered a kind of a challenge to that person and ultimately rejected. And if you think about in that kind of hub and spoke leadership model where your brain is at the hub and everyone else is a spoke and they present things, but you are the final decider, and then you end up complaining about no one cares as much as you do. And you create a culture that just focuses everything on you. And it's not really a way to harness the collective wisdom of your organization. And so once you get to that point where you just think, gosh, there's got to be another way, then you're ready to move on into what you might call post-heroic territory. Whereas before, you were the hero of the story. You're the smartest person in the room. You led the charge. Your ideas are best. You come in earliest in the morning and turn the lights out at night. To get to that post-heroic place, that's really what my coaching has always been about. And there is an example of how you can do that through regular coaching that I covered with Tara. But I should just stop for a moment. Are we talking about what you want to talk about, or?
I think this is just a joy to talk about anything with you and kind of have another deep dive. But I'm also looking out for our audience. I think your the book that you've co-written, Leadership Agility, really introduces these stages of adult development. And I found that message really inspiring because I think we're familiar about children's development, and we kind of assume that it just progresses. And it seems like a lot of adults, leaders or not leaders, right, like get stuck, and they could be stuck in the kind of a plateau of their ability to influence and engage their organization in a positive way, in a way where that really uplifts others. And so maybe you could walk us through a little bit of kind of the theory b behind it, and then like get into an application, as you said. And we've just gone through that with me recently, right? Like so, so like, but the theoretical framework of this development theory would maybe anchor people so they could recognize, well, here's where I am on this journey.
Well, I think what you can tell where you are if in a conversation you're actually genuinely curious in what other people think, and you're ready to hold their ideas as legitimate and perhaps even better than yours. Or you can collaborate with them at that moment, and life becomes much more enjoyable. If you find yourself having those conversations, then when you look back on it, you're not really interested in being the hero of the story of emerging as the smartest person in the room. I forget who it was, but someone was talking about it was Disraeli or somebody like that. I'm gonna
Oh
butcher
yes,
the name.
the difference between Gladstone and Disraeli, is this the one that you're thinking
So
of?
why don't you say what that is?
I will try, but apparently the mom of Winston Churchill, who was quite a socialite in her days, of Victorian era, spoke to these two major leaders, and both were prime ministers at a certain point in time. And she said, well, I spoke to Gladstone one evening, and at the end of this evening, I was rather certain that he's the cleverest man in all of Great Britain. And then, a few weeks later, she was sitting next to Disraeli, and afterwards she said, well, I was rather certain after that that I was the cleverest woman in all of Britain. And I think that is, if, did I get that right? Is that
Yeah,
the
you did get it
I
right,
think the
and better
accent
than
was
I
a
could have done.
little accent is a little rusty, but there's something that is that the feeling that you make other people come to alive versus showing off? Is that one way of thinking?
It is. It is. And what comes with that also is the capacity to really put yourself in the other person's shoes and care about it. So, and one way I can help people experience that in coaching is when they have some kind of difficult, pivotal conversation or negotiation that they're trying to prepare for. So I have a very specific way that I help them prepare, and that way goes something like this. I
Okay.
listen to a description of what it is they want to accomplish in the negotiation. And I ask them, okay, if you were talking to them right now, what would you say to them? And they tell me what it is. You know, they have certain points they have certain demands, maybe even, and ways of framing things. And I write all that down in great detail. And then I say, okay, well, let's do a little role play exercise. But it's not role play like you would usually imagine. You're actually going to play your counterpart, the person who you're going to be negotiating with. Let's call him Bob. So you be Bob. And when you're Bob, I want you to really be him as much as you can. So I want you to sit the way he sits. I want your vocal cadence to be his vocal cadence. I want you to even breathe the way you imagine him breathing. Just be him as much as possible, like you're some kind of method actor. And then what I want you to do is I'm going to interview you. So, and portray him without being a caricature of him, and just answer honestly to my questions. So then he gets into that role, and I try to make it deeper into the role. I just say, well, what is it that you think has brought you to this conversation? I understand you're going to talk to Alex on Tuesday at 4 o'clock. And what concerns are you bringing to that conversation? And why does that matter to you? And even before that, I could say, well, who's at home for you? You know, who populates your home? Do you have a spouse? Do you have kids, goldfish, dogs? What, you know, and the person answers as much as they can, and tries to get into that, and then get back to what are the concerns, and why is that important, and why is that important, and what's at stake for you in this conversation, and so what, you know, and I try to get everything that's bringing them there to that moment, and then I say, well, you know, I happen to know what Alex is going to say to you. Would you like to hear it? And of course, they say yes. And if they don't, that's very interesting too. But no one has ever said no. And so then I read all the things that Alex was going to say. And typically, the reaction from Bob's point of view, Alex being Bob now, is, ooh, that's not going to work so well. And yikes, that's not so good either. And said, oh, that's a pretty good point. And so it's kind of a mix. And then I would ask, okay, so come out of that role, and what did you learn from that? And usually that person learns a lot of things, and they sort of rearrange what they were going to say. And then I also say at that point, so is there anything about Bob that is off-putting to you, that annoys you about Bob? And you know, they can say things like, no, he's a self-important jerk. You know, it's like I can't stand him, or whatever it is, he's an asshole, or etc. And then you say, okay, so here's the second part of it. I want you to just settle into a meditative state. And by then, the client and I have been working on meditation, and they're capable of getting into this kind of neutral, relaxed place. And then I say, okay, if you were doing what you're saying that Bob does, if you were behaving in the way he does, what emotions would have to be driving it in you? And so then my client would then, they're capable at this point in their training of kind of feeling that in their body, and then even bringing it, those body feelings and energies to their face, and even affects their facial expression. They can understand what emotions are driving it in this guy. And then you say, okay, so let's there's a way, and we don't have to go into it in detail, but there's a way of getting them to feel where that emotion is in their body and to be able to dissolve it and get back to a neutral state. And the reason that that's important is because when people are upset with someone else, it's often, sometimes it's because they're saying, well, I would never do that. I don't have that element in me. They have it in them, and now I judge them. But actually, we're all capable of having a whole raft of huge amount of emotions. And it's often, sometimes it's the case that I'm secretly just like Bob,
Right,
only
that's what I just can't admit it to myself,
yeah, I
or
can't admit it to myself, or I don't want to, but on some occasions I actually do act just like Bob. So if you get rid of that in yourself, that reactivity to that state, then it's much easier to have that conversation with Bob. And so at that point, they take the sort of reconfigured set of things that they would bring to the conversation. And then where it's appropriate, it's not always appropriate to turn it into a collaboration, but sometimes it is. Then I could say, you could take some version of starting the conversation like this. You could say, in preparation for this conversation, I've been thinking what it might be like to be in your shoes. And if I were in your shoes, I would be concerned about this and this. And I'll tell you the kinds of things that I'm concerned with too. And my proposal is that if we lay that on the table, can we arrive at some kind of agreement that accomplishes what both of us need to accomplish in this relationship that we're talking about, or this deal, or whatever it is, but that it would be fair and even-handed, and that we could walk away from it seeing that. And sometimes it's important that the relationship preserve itself too in some of those conversations, and that helps that as well. So what they get in that, having gone through that experience, oh, by the way, I should say one thing. The things that you imagine Bob feels are not necessarily what Bob feels. That's, you're not being psychic and getting an exact read on Bob, but what you are getting is an exact read on you. And if you can dissolve that in yourself, then you're much more available to a conversation with Bob and to find out what he really is instead of your projections.
This is beautiful. If I kind of summarize a couple things that are striking me as I'm listening to this. So one of them is obviously that you want to try on the other person's shoes and then wear them for some time to really kind of connect with that. So that's kind of allows you then to be more one with the other person, versus oftentimes if it's a difficult conversation, the narrative is I versus them, and like there's this sort of weird divisive, and here you're sort of bringing that. And then the second piece, and this is something I really wanted to touch on, is that we're treating the interaction with this other person, the quote unquote difficult interaction, almost as a gift that allows us to unlock some of the things that could be holding us back. And because most likely, like as you said, like there could be subconscious or conscious triggers that are something that is very uncomfortable, that we're uncomfortable with, because if we didn't have that reaction, there we would probably be more accepting, and it would be a less difficult of a conversation or relationship in the first place. Am I getting that right? That this
Yeah,
is.
oh, that's perfect. You know, the other thing I'm thinking of is, the purpose of meditation isn't just to relax you. You know, it's taught as a stress reduction technique,
That's
and
right.
it does do that, but that's not the main contribution. The main contribution is, and I always think of it this way, it's like if you and I were standing outside a room that was completely dark, and we're at the door, and now we want to open the door and we want to explore what's in that room, every little corner. And but we don't have a clear light to go see what's in the room. What we have instead is a slide projector under our arm, and it's projecting slides, and that's what we're using to see in the room. We're seeing the slides on the wall and trying to figure out what's there. But in our minds, in general, that's how we perceive the world, with our own preoccupations, our own memories of even traumatic events, and they're not even conscious memories. So our trying to see what is real is very difficult, and it becomes much easier if you have a meditative technique that sort of dissolves those slides. Maybe not the total memory of the slide, but dissolves the sort of a bit of the hue falls away, and more clear light can come through. So gradually, as you progress, fewer and fewer of these early childhood experiences are coloring your perceptions of the moment or nagging at you. Or, I've coached people who, because of their reactivity to colleagues or direct reports, this one person ended up ruminating just about that for weeks, and unable to let it go and unable to engage with the person who said what they considered a slight. And there are ways to sort of clear the decks, not only the what that person said, but all the experiences growing up in childhood that made you so vulnerable to that moment and react so fiercely beyond what the situation even called for.
Yeah, I could definitely relate to that. When you were describing the slide metaphor, it almost made me think of Plato's allegory of the cape. But it was a modern take on it, because I think in Plato's, this was like some absolute truth that you're trying to strive through the light versus the shadows that you're seeing. And what you're bringing is like, this is our the slides are our limited perception, and we could, like, the word dissolution is an important one. How would you say the childhood patterns, for lack of a better word, are impacting not just the work world, but our holistic approach to life, in various roles that we may have? This is something that we just recently explored, where an accident was, where I overreacted with something with my son. You helped me work that through, but there's probably, I was also reacting to a pattern from my own childhood that in the process, And I think a lot of people, especially they they're achieved some degree of success and well known in the industry and so on, and then it feels a little silly to go back to something that kind of was back in your childhood, maybe. Like, how do you help people work through that and kind of unlock some of those things that are not serving us anymore?
Well, it depends. So let's say that the person has, I always think of this one client I had who, sometimes when people have these 360 degree surveys where people are talking about them, and there's a point someplace in there where they get to complain about things or things that they would like the person to develop. And this one guy was highly sarcastic. And so you could teach him linguistically what to do instead of being sarcastic. But the more interesting thing is there's a part of him that really loves to be sarcastic and needs to be sarcastic. So, and the coaching, you can kind of say, okay, I know that's not all of you, it's just a part of you. But let's talk to that part. Let's imagine we could have a conversation with that part that's responsible for that. So we have that conversation a little bit, and then you ask that part, okay, so what is it that you want to accomplish through this sarcasm? And then, so the guy says, set the record straight. And then, and there are other places to go with this, but let's stay with set the record straight, or just say, I'm in charge here, or whatever it is they come up with. And then you say, well, what would happen? What would you feel if you didn't do that? If you weren't able to set the record straight or be in charge? And then the person, is enough in touch, if they're enough in touch with their emotions, they would feel like threatened in some way or afraid. And then you can say, okay, so is that a new thing, or when? Or you could say the part, so when did you first feel it was necessary to come online to protect, let's say it's you, Alex, when to protect Alex? You'd say, when I was five, or something like that. And then there are various things you can do to take the sting out of that emotion, or that remembered situation at five. And it doesn't take very long to do. It's not hard to do. And so it's not like deep therapy or anything, but it takes the reactivity away from it, so that when it happens, when that part has to come online, at present, it's not so reactive and not so driven. So, I think of our family life as when you get born into a family, it's like being your family is like a boat full of people, a sort of a big rowboat. Everyone's standing there and it's kind of sinking. It's not completely sound, this
There's no
boat.
perfect family and everything
Yeah,
ever,
yeah.
ever.
So you get put in the boat and you get handed a bailing can, and that's your role in the family. And it can be a surprising role. Sometimes you're the best child. Sometimes you're the kid who steals hubcaps, so the parents can come together and stop fighting and worry about you. Sometimes, it can be a whole bunch of things. But those things that you learn early in your family, they stay with you. And so later they become, when you bring them up to date, and they're no longer necessary for the dire reasons that they were early in your family. The war is over. Your dad isn't beating you anymore. It's like, it's like
Can
you can
relax.
survive without that. So you take that sting away, and then all the coping mechanisms that you learned to deal with that are still there. so that you can use them positively and when they're appropriate. So you never lose anything. You just aren't compelled to use it in a way that's unwarranted and sometimes destructive.
Well, if you're listening to this, you're probably an overachiever of some degree.
We hope so.
Yeah, and so a lot of the observation, partially on my own experience, but the like also seeing patterns of some classmates from, business schools and undergrad, and is that they came out swinging. Right, it was like the need to prove themselves, and my journey has been maybe that of Soviet refugee escape, and then going and proving yourself in the new country and professionally overcoming whatever we had to overcome. And so people haven't, family situation, loss in the family, other tragedies, but there's a drive for a lot of the overachiever personalities to prove yourself to the world, prove yourself to your parents, prove, prove, prove. And eventually, it seems there's a pattern where they kind of reach that acclaim, reach by hook or by crook, reach some degree of accomplishment, got to that leadership role for, and then it's either they're never nothing is enough if they've succeeded there, or it feels hollow, or they just a lot of damage along the way of having gotten there and applying that same drive. So what are your advice for that person?
Well, it's I hope that they're dissatisfied because that really helps. It's my toughest clients have been, well, actually, these people don't usually come to me because they're not far enough along to want what we're talking about. But the people who are like super rich or also celebrities. I've coached celebrities in my day, and very few of them can manage to engage in the kind of change work that we're talking about. And it's really tough. If you've got enough money or enough celebrity, then people are always you can't necessarily trust who's talking to you and what they really want, because they're thinking you could write them a check and their life would change. It's hard. And you watch, I mean, we're watching President Trump. I can really feel for him. Not that he feels this, but people don't tell him the truth. And he's leading the most powerful country in the world, and people won't tell him the truth. And he's gotten so that if it isn't at the right level as sycophancy, he won't accept it. And people just sort of pour treacle on the biscuit, and that's the only way they can get him to listen to them. Now, how can you be an effective leader if reality gets distorted for you all the time? I mean, that's really tough. So I had this one story. It's not that I was, going to become a celebrity, but in my younger days, I was a classical guitarist and also a singer-songwriter, and I was on Cape Cod, and I had performed at this one place, and there was a producer from New York in the audience, and it was one of those nights I just had everybody in the palm of my hand, and when I was that age, I was handsome, etc. So one thing led to another. I got driven to Sardi's in New York in a limousine, and I'm sitting there with four producers from Desilu Studios, and they're saying, We're going to make a series of five movies with you as the star. And the first one will be about a young classical guitarist who goes to Europe and loses himself in the rock and roll scene. And it'll just be a vehicle for your stardom. And so what do you say? And I said, no. And they said, what? I said, no, I don't want to do it. And they said, why? And I said, because I'm 22. I think I was 22 then. I'm 22 years old and I don't know who I am. And if I do this, I'm never going to know who I am. And so no. And they said, well, don't sign with anybody else, displaying the fact that they hadn't heard a word I said. And that was the end of that. And when I look back on that, I'm super glad that that happened. And I'm not thinking that, I would necessarily have been the star that they were trying to make me into. But what I did instead was to pay attention to the parts of myself that needed real friends, needed an honest look, so that I actually could, take some of the slides out of that projector and be real. And I wasn't feeling that then. I just felt like, I felt like, I should just go straight to rehab. Forget the movie.
Well, and it's beautiful. I know you have amazing stories of, spending time with Leonard Bernstein, another, famous musician. But maybe back on your own journey, like when you look back now, was the wisdom that you bring to your clients, there's that this moment that you described. Are there other one or two moments that
Yeah,
took
well,
you in certain directions?
okay. So when I was, I think it was before the story I just told you, but I was deeply, madly in love with this young woman. And I really wanted to marry her. My two best friends had already gotten married. People were getting married young those days. And I used to ask her to marry me all the time. And she just, refused. And then one night we had this great day, and at night we were developing and printing photographs in a studio that I had rigged up in our apartment. And it was like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and we got into bed, and I said, this is the happiest day of my life. This has been the best day of my life. And she said, yeah, me too. And then I said, so why won't you marry me? And then she said, I will. And then I said, oh, that's nice. I started drifting off to sleep. And then she started poking me. She said, I said something to you. And then I said, what? She said, I will marry you. And then I said, oh, that's wonderful. And then, we kissed and hugged and drift off to sleep. Next morning, I wake up, I look at her, and there's a voice in my head that says, fuck you, get away from me. Get the fuck away from me. And I was horrified. And that voice wouldn't shut up. And it just kept on going. I didn't know what to do with it.
Was
I
that
brought
your
it to,
voice or was that her
it
voice?
was an internal voice
Of
in
your voice.
me that was spiteful, angry, resentful. Our relationship fell apart. I decided I would go to Japan and study Aikido, which I had been studying, and blah, blah, blah. But I had never been able to actually. I didn't know where it came from, and I was convinced that I was insane. And I was also convinced that I would never be able to love anyone. So I was deeply, deeply depressed. And Later, I in some kind of group therapy sort of thing, I discovered what was at the base of it. And what was at the base of it was when I was 3 months old, my mother, who had lost her first child, who was a boy at 3 months old, and had then my two older sisters, when I got to be 3 months old, she thought I was going to die of sudden infant, death syndrome, SIDS. And so my father said, "Well, you're so nervous, let's just go on a vacation." So they went on a vacation and left me with this, with a nurse who turned out to be not so nice. And so I started refusing food. And by the time my parents came back, a couple of weeks later, I imagine, I was being fed intravenously. And that turned out to be what embedded this incredible fear of really allowing myself to give and receive love because it didn't work out when I was 3 months old. And because it was pre-verbal, then there was no conscious memory of it. And it's also particularly destructive pre-verbally because there's no sense of self and other. So something bad has happened, but it must be me. And that turned out to be a gift because it led me, there's a reason that I have practiced 2, 3 hours a day for 60 years, practically never missing a day. And that is what led to my consciousness opening up. But you don't have to be as severely disturbed as I was, and there's no remnant of that in my consciousness anymore. But most people, if they hadn't done what I had done, they would still be suffering from some wild character disorder at my age, and I'm 80 years old. And I feel fine.
Still got those looks, the movie star looks. And
Well, I don't know about that, but I do look at all of that as a gift now. And I think most of my clients end up feeling that way about their past, even if it wasn't, I've plenty of my clients, when they really look into it, have had some pretty rough childhoods. And you can get rid of that. You can really let that can go.
And it sounds like that lack of love or acceptance as a child is what for many people propels them to achieve and to drive and to make things in the world and earn the love, so to speak. But the irony is that that is not that that is a that's the wrong search almost, or at least it's kind of gets you to a point where you're an
Oh,
expert. That's good, right?
you can have it all. You can do them
Right.
both.
Right. Okay.
So that you can achieve things in the world. But the
Right.
question is, what's the fuel that's powering it? And is it this just trying to prove something? Or when that stuff goes away and that's not the driving force, then the desire is a creative. It's
Right.
to create something that's useful to, maybe millions of people, or to change the world for the better. And it also extends to the kind of culture you create, because not only do you not want to do it because you're shot from cannons with this particular agony of your childhood, but you want to create a culture in which people really respect and support each other And where back to the collective
Right.
intelligence is very high, and people are excited and love each other's contributions and work because they want to make something great. And so you can do that.
So in Silicon Valley, it's a bit trite to say that I want to change the world, right? Like I have this big idea, it's gonna change the world. And there's leaders that do accomplish that, right? But they do it in a way that is that leaves a lot of hurt souls and the damage in the path. But there's still like this benefit and the ambition to have impact. It feels like it's driven maybe from a slightly different place. Is that
I
something that
think
you've
so, and
seen?
I think people, grow along the way. I
Right.
mean, I don't know what Bill Gates is really like, but I've heard some conversations with. There was one podcast where Rashida Jones and Bill Gates were interviewing Yuval Noah Harari. And Bill Gates came out great. So did Harari, and so did Rashida Jones as well. But it was just a really sane conversation, and I think that's great. I think it's wonderful to create, and I know that Bill Gates, if that's where he's ended up these days, and that was probably about 5 years ago, I think that conversation. He's changed along the way. In the
That's
beginning,
right. Right.
he stole stuff from people. I mean, he hollowed out other people's inventions, and he was ruthless in the beginning. I don't think he's that way now. I think people can evolve. Warren Buffett, I don't know what he's like. I never had a conversation with him, but he strikes me as a guy who's living in the same, three bedroom tract house or whatever it is, that he's always had, and it's and also his idea about what to do with his money, how to protect his children. What would you do as a child growing up with billions of dollars?
Right.
It's that kind of distortion of reality is it's hard to be sane. I mean, that's huge compared to deciding not to be a movie star. I mean, that's already upon you. It's really tough.
So on that note, when you look at whether it's the movie stars that make this transition who are famous or the ultra rich who maybe had a crisis of some kind or, horrible divorce or whatever is this thing, when you're coaching that person, or those that don't need the coaching that you admire, like, from an outside, obviously, like, what are the characteristics of the leaders, the sort of the post-heroic leaders, and the how what's the difference between the ones that come there a little bit quicker with a little bit less stumbles and the ones that take a long and painful journey to get there?
I think the real difference is that they're totally honest with themselves, and they're totally relaxed, welcome feedback, and they're humble about themselves, and they have a good sense of humor, and they're willing to make mistakes and laugh about them, or do the kind of meditative processes, but they just feel real, and that's a great thing. But my approach is kind of Taoist, and Well, I shouldn't say kind of. It really is Taoist. And there's a lot. If you read the Tao Te Ching, which is quoted a lot in that book of mine you're reading, Dragons at Work,
Yes.
the there are things like, which means more to you or your renown? Which brings more to you or what you own? And which would cost you more if it was gone? Stuff like that. There's another one, those who would take over the earth and shape it to their will never, I notice, succeed. The earth is like a vessel so sacred that at the mere approach of the profane, it is marred. And when they reach out their fingers, it is gone. I think I can remember the rest. For a time in the world, some force themselves ahead, and some are left behind. For a time in the world, some make a great noise, and some are held silent. For a time in the world, some are puffed fat, and others are left hungry. For a time in the world, some push aboard and some are pushed out. But at no time in the world will a man who is sane overreach himself, overspend himself, overrate himself.
Thank you for sharing.
So you think, that was written 2,500 years ago. It's been with us for a while.
Yeah.
It's part of the human condition.
Well, I put this background for those of you watching the video to reflect as my special appreciation of uncovering that wisdom. And it's, it's somebody who in my head comes from kind of a classical progress, tradition where you push things, force things. It's a very interesting to see that you could accomplish that, but not through force necessarily, but through letting that energy flow through you and not dividing yourself from others, but seeing yourself as an extension of the broader space and this other people around you. How do you find that your clients that you work with that are not exposed to Taoist tradition, kind of react to that? And like, what kind of a shift in mindset do you see happen as you expose them to this wisdom?
The way I do it, what I've found over the years is that those poems, a lot of them are really impenetrable for when we first read them. They're puzzling, they're
Yeah.
paradoxical. So here's an example. I'm trying to think of the first line of this one. The universe is deathless. Deathless because, with no finite self, it stays infinite. A sound man, by not advancing himself, stays the further ahead of himself. By not confining himself to himself, sustains himself outside himself. By never being an end in himself, he endlessly becomes himself. Now there's a lot to unwrap in that one. And unless you have the experience of what it's like to sort of drop the self, then that makes no sense. So the way I introduce it to people is I, through meditative experiences, get them to be in a place where they really experience that self differently. And so, for instance, we can do a little of this now. So just start visually, and then with your eyes open, expand your peripheral vision so that it's soft. And then bring your attention and your awareness to your eyes, just the tissue membranes, the lens, all the optic nerve and that whole apparatus. And just rest in the experience of the eyes being space, so that you're resting in the space that your eyes occupy, and then resting in the space that's outside your eyes. So that outside your eyes, the space outside and inside, is continuous space. And also rest in the space that your brain occupies in your head. And just feel that space outside and inside. And then the more familiar you become with that space, the more it starts to feel like that's an aspect of you. As a matter of fact, the fundamental aspect of you. And this is a very radical experience, but that all matter is really at its fundamental level, at its deepest level, is really space. With whatever the object is that you're looking at being a manifestation of that space. So that's a kind of a non-dual awareness where the self and other self and things, it's all really the same at a certain level. And that space has been talked about by mystics for centuries, thousands of years probably. And the more you can experience it, the more Lao Tzu's poetry makes sense. So, by never being an end in yourself, he endlessly becomes himself. So, that, and in that, you can find a kind of a stillness. You notice that if you go to a concert hall and the musicians are all tuning up and the conductor is standing at the podium, and then, all the instruments are sort of tuning up and, there's this cacophony there. And then the conductor taps the podium with his wand or her wand, and everything's silent. But it isn't really just silence. There's a kind of a room noise or room sound that's sort of pregnant with possibility. And that sense of it's totally alive, and yet there's no real sound yet. Then the orchestra is going to play over that, and you'll hear phrases that complete themselves and little pauses, rests in the music. But, and then it's all over this room sound. And this room sound is that energy of the universe that all things are arising in. And so what happens is you end up feeling the stillness between the motion and the stillness between the sounds, the silence between the sounds. And that becomes more available to you all the time. And once that happens, that's equal to any wealth that you can imagine.
Reflecting for many of our audience, maybe who are not into classical music performance, But it's getting to winter time and people are going to be out in the snow. And there's this beautiful moment when you're walking in the snow, maybe not surrounded by but a hustle and bustle, but in a kind of a private space. And you've just become part of the forest, and you see the light glistening off the snow and creating a little brilliant diamonds where just snow becomes like diamond-like. Hopefully you're not listening to a podcast and you have the birds chirping, and so you become part of this, beautiful, whether it's Alps or Rockies or Sierra Nevadas. And another for people that are into the sea and are going someplace warm. I think one of the phrases that really resonates with me is like, everybody, you're the wave, you're the wave in the ocean, and you're part of the ocean at the same time. And so you start feeling the sense of connectedness. I think it's beautiful if the meditations, teach you to have more of these awe-inspiring moments throughout the day versus, okay, that's my, like, I have my happy place when we go, in the summer and I swim, but imagine I could have that happy place in the open sea, every day, and it sounds like that's one of the gifts that you enable your clients with.
It's funny. I've heard people say that Taoism is a kind of quietism, that you just withdraw from everything. But if that's true, how come there are Taoist martial arts? Because there are. So you can be in a space like that, and it makes you a better martial artist. No fear, no hesitation.
Let's talk about that, because that is something that you've brought up several times in our conversations. And it's for those of you us that haven't studied martial arts, this is a great insight. Can you elaborate a little bit more on
Well, when
this?
I started, the first martial art I really studied was Aikido. And whether or not in the world of mixed martial arts, an Aikido master would get his head clobbered. That's not really what I think about with martial arts. When I think of Aikido, I think of Aikido as being so centered and skillful that whatever comes at you can't penetrate in a hurtful way the sort of sphere of energy that's around you. And the other thing is, whatever is coming at you, you meet it. So the hand coming in, you connect with it and touch it and lead it to some place that's not going to hurt anyone. And you've practiced enough so that you've got so much vital energy, so much chi in the Chinese way, or ki, and that is Japanese, that your movements have no tension in them, but they have this other kind of power and energy running through it. That's impenetrable. The best way to understand that kind of power is if you imagine a fire hose with huge amounts of water rushing through it. It becomes very stable, and you couldn't bend it at that point. But without the water rushing through, it just kind of flops to the ground, and it's the chi running through it, or the ki running through it, that makes it powerful. And so these that that's why they call them internal martial arts, because you're developing these internal powers that just in a very relaxed way, and skillful way, you're meeting the other person's energy, but you're not doing it with any tension in it. And that's a level attainment that is really beyond me. I'm not a real martial artist, although I do do Tai Chi and this other stuff called Bagua, which is a Chinese way of walking in circles that is related to the I Ching. And now I've just said things that nobody listening to this understands, but I apologize.
But that's but it's beautiful because what every it almost feels like every religious and spiritual tradition has some ways that reach this, you know, and you found yours in Tai Chi, and so you know I think you've practiced yoga at some point as well, and so it's you know you're just exploring and you know you're finding what supports you at different stages of your growth, and I think one of the things that really touched me is that you could it the meditative kind of this opportunities they're everywhere. They're not just in this sort of, you know, it's great if you can get your 30 minutes in the morning and you're kind of all, you know, all receptive and powerful throughout the day. But what as we discussed, one of my goals is to be able to kind of draw on these moments throughout. And then if you're inspired by a particular religious or spiritual tradition, you know, how do you integrate that practice because it's genuine, it's you, it's part of who you are. What, how do you help your clients find the thing that kind of responds to them and
I
makes it
think
part of them?
most all of my clients, if you ask them, especially going back to childhood, most kids really have some kind of very innocent feeling about the nature of the world. When I was, I remember in the fifth grade. I was new in the fifth grade, and I was a terrible, terrible reader. So they had me at the front of the room reading a poem, and the poem was, "I think I will never see something as something beautiful, lovely as a tree that looks at God all day." And I read it, "A tree that looks like God all day," and they just broke up. I was so mortified, but underneath, I remember at that moment thinking, actually, I'm right. It's a tree that looks like
Tree of
God
life.
all day. That's, yes, that's the way it is. And if you talk to most kids, they have moments where they were in bed at night and they had all kinds of wondering about the stars and so there is that you can always refer to. Some people have religious experiences, and they can still go to mass or synagogue, but if they're capable of really quieting down and getting the spirit that's behind the ritual, that can be good for some people. It's like that's fantastic, and that prayer starts to mean something to them.
It becomes kind of a deeper connecting experience versus just a ritual. And you know, the ritual could get you there, but the more intentional you are
Well, there's
with.
something wonderful about rituals, but they can be sort of dead if you're not feeling anything in the midst of participating in them. And so the way to get there is make yourself more of an alive instrument, a responsive instrument. And then, like my favorite thing to listen to right now is these South African a cappella, really gospel, but not like our gospel. But their harmonies and their rhythms and their and it's all about the love of Jesus and that Jesus w but it takes me away. I think there I've had so many different traditions that impact me. All I know is that they are sincere and also great musicians, and what they're saying totally gets to me.
That's beautiful. Stephen, like you bring up music and you bring up media a little bit, and I think the reality for most of us, or if not us, the people close to us or kids, is that we are just bombarded by probably the opposite of calm spiritual energy. We're bombarded by Instagram and what other people have and how everything is great there, and negative news cycles that sell the news but also bring a lot of anxiety, divisive rhetoric, us versus them type of mindset, commercial entities trying to obviously sell us something. How do you, whether we need it or not, and to evoke unmet needs, I'll be enough when I have that luxury item or that experience type of sale. So what is the counterbalance to what the world that you're helping your clients and the world you're living in,
Well, I
is
think
that?
each of us has to find out what's the proper balance. I mean, you can tune the world out to a great extent if you make that decision to do it. And but I don't like to be totally divorced from the world. I like to know what's going on, and I
And
have
we have
several.
leaders who need to connect to the world, because that they are in the world. They're not like Zen monks, away from everywhere. So sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted
Yeah,
to
no,
speak
especially
to
if you
our
have a
audience.
role like that. But even, I think the Dalai Lama knows what's going on, and he still meditates. I mean, I always think of, Lao Tzu says, a sound leader's aim is to open peace people's hearts, fill their stomachs, calm their wills, brace their bones. And so to clarify their thoughts, cleanse their needs, so no cunning meddler can touch them. And there are a lot of cunning meddlers out there. And some of the just the sources that you mentioned, and getting caught in some weird Twitter feed or video, endless video watching, stuff like that. That just seems to me to just suck on our vital energy, and it's destructive. So.
I want to touch a little bit on the heart, and maybe in the context we kind of as we were talking earlier, of kind of unlocking your mind, right? Like this conversation, some of us like great new concepts. There's kind of, they will go check out your discussion with Tara, I hope, and start learning intellectually a lot of these ideas. And I think that's in some ways where I got started, was exploring this, maybe intellectually. That's a strong muscle for some. Then there you brought up the heart, and that's a muscle that, I think we need to remind ourselves on a regular basis that if we, are we doing something from love, and then just being aware of our emotional state. And then there's this nervous system connection, right? And in the multidimensionality that you kind of reach through meditation. If people are looking to make change, it appears that you need all three to some degree, but where do you start, where's the right emphasis? Is there a single answer to this? How would you think about this?
I think it really depends You have to tune into the individual. And I like to help build a nervous system that's resilient and can support everything else. When it comes to compassion, some people are very responsive to the idea of praying, for the benefit of all people, and projecting love and compassion. For me, I found that difficult because of that early experience I was talking about. But love wasn't the thing that was central to me because I felt there was kind of a void there. But what developed it in me was being able to take the very difficult emotions that I felt. Like, at the basis of that experience was a deep sadness. And so to be able to find that sadness in my system, in my body someplace, or my energetic field, and to really surround it with this bigger space I was talking about. And then to have, so it's a way of having compassion for yourself and letting the tension around that, because there's sadness, and then there's also there can be, with sadness, there can be layers of anger about it, or resentment, and all that has to dissolve. And the more compassion you can have, or the more you dissolve it in yourself, the more you develop compassion for yourself, and there, and automatically for others.
Sounds like people start with the narrative in the religious traditions, kind of, is to compassion for others. That's socially acceptable that we're compassionate, and so we're doing a lot of virtue signaling in some ways to show that. But what I'm hearing is, a lot of the real work is to actually accept yourself. Because until you genuinely accept and have compassion for yourself, it's going to be hard to really be authentically, really compassionate for others.
That's true for me. That was true for me. It's not true for everyone.
So some people could get from compassion to start with a lot of.
Some people, it's just part of their nature. Just have to go with what is arising and work with it. So I don't have an automatic way of working with people. I have to find out who they are.
What are the biggest blocks for people that start working with you, and then they discover this is not, there's some quick fixes and quick wins. But there's sidesteps, right? And I we were talking about my own, like, hey, I was doing great here, and then I had a sidestep, and you helped me kind of work through that. But like, how do you find that journey works for most people?
I really trust people to do that for themselves. So, when I've the way I work with, first of all, at 80 years old, I'm not working with that many people anymore. And what I usually do is have a conversation with him, and then do a little bit of work with them to find out if they're responsive. And then if I think that I can be useful, then I'll offer them coaching. But if I don't think I can be useful, and how I see them respond to the kinds of direction that I think would be good for them, and they don't seem to like it, then I can look back, and maybe I can try another way. But if I find out that they don't like that, then I cheerfully refer them to someone else, because at this stage, I want to work with people for whom I'm most useful. And, not everybody qualifies.
What advice would you give to your 50-year-old self?
You're doing fine.
Were you worried?
Probably, but I would just say it's all going to work out. Trust yourself. You're doing all right.
Some people that are listening to this are in that kind of age where they have maybe young or teenage kids. Their career is like umping their energy level, and they start, dropping off if they haven't been doing Aikido like you, or kind of a practice. And there's a lot of demands on their time from coming from all sorts of places. And then, like as we said, there's all this external environment of not always calming noise, but like distracting noise. How do you help? Like you can't do everything, right? I think it feels like in my head, like it feels like you kind of accept that you can't do everything, and you just start focusing on one thing at a time, and just accepting that you're not an Indian god quite yet was all the extra hands, and that maybe gives a sense of peace. But what have you found for people that are kind of going, yes, they have the past, but they're just in this nadir of life where there's a lot of responsibilities on them.
I think the main thing that they have to develop is trust. Like you said, what would you tell your 50-year-old? Just trust yourself. You're all right. And so what happens is if we have coaching sessions together, I want them to have the experience that no matter what they bring to the conversation, that by the end, they've gotten another bit of evidence that they can trust themselves and that it's all right. You're going to be okay.
It's a beautiful message. Stephen, any other words of wisdom other than we're going to be okay? And we can build trust in ourselves that you would like to share with our audience.
Yeah, I think I just want to recite a poem, if I can remember this one. This is from Lao Tzu. Existence is beyond the power of words to define. Terms may be used, but none of them are absolute. In the beginning of heaven and earth, there were no words. Words came out of the womb of matter. And whether a man dispassionately sees to the core of life or passionately sees the surface, the core and the surface are essentially the same. Words making them seem different only to express appearance. If name be needed, wonder names them both. From wonder into wonder, existence opens.
Wow. How do you top that? You're leaving us all with a sense of wonder and curiosity. First of all, some of us are wondering, will we remember and be able to recite poems at the age of 80 when we're struggling much younger in our life to do that? So
That's
that's an
probably all I
advert.
can remember.
It's pretty good. That's an advertisement. Right there for drinking whatever you're drinking and doing whatever you're doing. But it's beautiful, this sense of curiosity and wonder that I've experienced in working with you, because what you and I think they use that word dissolution, is you bring up these unspoken things that kind of are holding us up, or the fears or whatever, and you kind of bring a curiosity about, well, maybe some of that is true, or some, and then you go the opposite, where we aspire to be, where, maybe there's another alternative. But throughout both, there's a sense of wonder and acceptance of the beautiful texture of human life and our connectedness. And I think this is so special, and I feel such a privilege to have had this conversation and a few
Same.
previous ones with you. What a gift of wisdom. Connecting this to the younger version of yourself, I've heard some expression that you want to have the wisdom of the 80-year-old, and the heart of a 5-year-old. And I think your loving acceptance is great. But then you have the energy of a samurai, or, well, maybe a Tai Chi master as well. And that's something that's very special, to combine all of these traits in one, Stephen. So where could people get more of your magic?
I guess you can go on stephenjosephs.com, see what's there. I haven't looked at that for a while, but that's one way.
Beautiful. Stephen, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
That
It's
was a pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
a lifetimes of reading and re-listening here in this episode
Yeah,
alone.
well, I've enjoyed our conversation. I think what you brought to it on your end is quite lovely. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, relayto.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.